Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
And Homeopathy World Community founder, Debbie Brock. Debbie Brock will not be joining us today. She's traveling, but we have a special guest, Rich Roberts, who's the manager of the Pandemic Response Project. He will be joining us at the end of the first half hour for the following hour to talk together with me about some of the latest vaccine news. This is Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips talking to you from Asheville, North Carolina. And welcome to the show this afternoon. Afternoon here on the East Coast, noon Central Time, 11 Mountain, and 10 Pacific Time. Good morning to those of you in the western part of the U.S. Lots to talk about today. And just a quick reminder, this show is a combination of a prior show that was a Homeopathy World Community show and a new show with Freedomizer Radio. So we're going out to both Freedomizer Radio audiences and Homeopathy World Community folks. Welcome to both groups and all of you. Glad to have you with us today. Lots to talk about. I had someone send me an email recently, somebody with a sense of humor, showing me a graph from the late 90s to on into the 2007 or so range, spanning about roughly 10 years, a graph showing increasing autism rates across that spectrum, which, of course, many people attribute in some part, if not large part, to vaccines, and the increase in organic food sales. And the curves are virtually identical. Of course, somebody jokingly saying, oh, look, it must be the rise in organic food sales that's causing autism. Not likely, folks. Not likely. But it does actually raise a good scientific point, and a lot of times people mistakenly conclude from a correlation that there is necessarily a causal relationship between things being compared. And this is simply just not scientifically valid. In other words, just because there is a correlation between two things doesn't mean that there's a causal relationship to them. I remember someone talking years ago about a study where they found that people who drank coffee had higher rates of heart problems, and they were tempted to conclude, or maybe even did tentatively conclude, that coffee is bad for your heart. And later discovered on closer examination that more of the coffee drinkers were smokers than non-coffee drinkers, and that it may very well have been the cigarettes and not the coffee that was causing the heart problem. So you have to be careful about correlations. However, the fact that a correlation is not proof of causation does not mean that a correlation, that just because there's a correlation, the relationship between the two things being compared is irrelevant. And let me give you an example. There was a study in the last year or two that found that for every 1% increase in vaccine coverage, there were more than 600 additional autism cases. Does that mean increasing vaccination rates causes an increase in autism? No, it doesn't mean that scientifically at all. But it is a darn good reason to do more research to see if we can determine whether or not there's a causal relationship. When you see a correlation like that, the only reasonable response, the only healthy response, speaking in a psychological sense with the word healthy there, would be to jump all over that, take a look and see if you can prove or disprove a causal relationship. The autism vaccine connection is a highly political issue, and every bit as controversial as it is political, because the mainstream authorities keep coming out with more studies claiming that here's proof the vaccines don't cause autism. And the reason I say it's highly political is because we now know that they know that vaccines do cause autism. So this is just a propaganda game. And let me clarify why I say that. The study I mentioned was not an isolated instance. There was another study in the last couple of years, a review actually, by a researcher who is a former senior pharmaceutical researcher, Helen Ratajczak. She did a review of the autism literature from back in the 1940s to present day at the time her study was published a couple of years ago, I think, at this point, somewhere in the last couple of years. And she concluded that vaccines are a cause of autism. Wasn't even saying there's a correlation here to look further into. She said vaccines are a cause of autism. End of story there. There was... what was the other study? There was a third study, I'm trying to remember now, that had some evidence there. Third study that said that aluminum may be causally related to vaccines. See, sometimes studies will give you leads, so to speak, rather than a hard conclusion. Depends on the nature of the study. But this was a study that concluded. These are all peer-reviewed, published studies. So as trustworthy as any peer-reviewed published study, which is a whole separate question because we also have compelling evidence that the medical literature industry is fraught with fraud and deceit at a level that renders the entire bulk of medical literature subject to question, in the sense that we can no longer just trust a study based on what it says. But in any case, let me back up a little bit to where I was starting there. There's a study that showed a correlation, or I came up with a, they concluded that there's a possible causal relationship between the aluminum in vaccines and autism. Again, not straightforward proof, but real good reason to do further research to explore that relationship further. And yet what we see is denial after denial after denial, and denial of studies that do show a relationship or good reason to explore further in a particular direction, denial that there's any problem with the vaccine program at all. We, the Institutes of Medicine, I think it was, who recently came out and said that we don't need to do a study comparing vaccinated to unvaccinated children because the vaccine program is safe. Anyone who can't see the circular reasoning to that, it just doesn't really have a place in the conversation at all, frankly. No offense intended to anyone. But that is just so absurd on its face as to render anybody who would make that as an official position not worthy of being in the position they're in to make that kind of a statement. It's just irrational on its face. And so disturbing to learn that there are people who actively and proactively hide unnecessary injury and death caused by the vaccine program. And this is all about protecting the people who benefit and profit from the industry, whether it's financially directly or indirectly, or in terms of career position or career path or career move. And it is critical that we as citizens in the U.S. and the rest of the world, because this is not a localized problem, this is an international problem, it is critical that we recognize and understand that there are people, important, powerful people, people in important positions, people in government and industry, people leading government and industry, who are willing to lie to protect themselves and their special interests, even when it means unnecessary injury and death of other people. And I think the reason so many people have a trouble wrapping their mind around the possibility that there could be anything wrong with vaccines or the vaccine program is because nobody would do that. Nobody would pass a law that's knowingly injuring and killing people. Nobody would approve a product, license a vaccine or any other product if it was really going to hurt somebody. People wouldn't do that. Nobody would really do that. Well, folks, we don't have to look very far back in history to find example after example after example of powerful people making decisions to further private agendas, their personal agenda or other private agendas, knowingly causing harm to others. And human beings hopefully are evolving to something better than what we were and what we are today, but the evolutionary process is usually usually a pretty slow process. There's really no significant difference between human beings today in terms of our overall capabilities and human beings a few years, decades, or centuries ago, maybe not even a few thousand years ago, but certainly not in terms of our general disposition or constitution or what we're capable of doing. Our technology has evolved considerably in the last 100 years, but we as beings, independent of that, have ourselves not evolved in a substantial way for quite some length of time at this particular point. We are every bit as capable today, we human beings, of the great achievements and the great horrors, both, that we as a race have perpetrated upon ourselves and the planet at any time in the last several hundred, if not several thousand years or more. Every bit is capable. And we need to recognize that not only is that a potential reality, but if you look closely, dig beneath the surface, look at the conflicts of interest, the documented information, that some pretty bad things are going on in the world today as we speak. And we need to become aware of it. We need to get clear about what really is happening, what isn't, what is clear information, what is disinformation, and look for ways to become involved and active in a way that we can help to heal these atrocious illnesses, if you want to call it that, create, for purposes of the focus of this show and vaccines, create a healthcare system that no longer kills and injures people unnecessarily and that actually, truly, and really, and consistently does seek to help people to achieve and maintain the best health possible as individuals, as communities and societies, as a nation, as a species on the planet. I'm going to move on to a wonderful little joke that someone sent me recently, and it is a joke, but it's an illustrative joke. It really does, I think, in a humorous way, describe how the political world works. So let me tell it to you here. Three contractors are bidding to fix a broken fence at the White House. Three contractors, broken fence at the White House. One's from Chicago, one from Tennessee, the third one is from Montana, and they all go to the White House with a White House official to examine the fence. The Montana contractor takes out a tape measure and does some measuring and works some figures on a pencil, and he says, "Well, I figure the job will run me about $900. That's $400 for materials, $400 for my crew, and $100 profit for me. $900. The Tennessee contractor also does some measuring and figuring, and he says, "Oh, I can do the job for $700. That's $300 for materials, $300 for my crew, and $100 profit for me." The Chicago contractor doesn't measure or figure, but leans over to the White House official and whispers, and the first two quotes were $900 and $700, and he whispers, $2,700. And the official, incredulous, says, "You didn't even measure like the other guys. How'd you come up with such a high figure?" And the Chicago contractor whispers back, "It's $1,000 for me, $1,000 for you, and we hire the guy from Texas to fix the fence." "Done," replies the government official. And, you know, it's really funny, but at the same time it's really sad, because we've all heard the stories of the $900 hammer that the Pentagon bought, or the, that kind of thing where they'll just use a different name so that it's not obvious that it's a hammer, and instead of charging $1.79 or $4 or whatever it is for a hammer, and depending on which one you get, and they'll put down $900. And I wouldn't be surprised at all, folks, if there was people in and out of government profiting from those kinds of arrangements all the time. I mean, why do governments even start wars in the first place? You notice that pretty much any place the U.S. has gone to overseas in the last several decades, if not longer, is the only time we send in troops is when it's a country that has oil reserves. And as soon as we achieve whatever sort of control level needed to send in the oil companies, we do that. So start wars to raise profits for their buddies there. Doesn't matter if we kill a few thousand Americans in the process, because there's too many people on the planet anyway, and they're expendable, and nobody will care. Well, you know, we're all of equal worth. Doesn't matter what your race or color or job or sex or anything else is. We're all human beings. I love this simple phrase that somebody said once, that God doesn't make mistakes. You know, we're all here. We're all here deliberately in one way or another. We're all ultimately of equal value. Nobody has any greater right to live or not live, or to profit from or reap the benefits of whatever there is to benefit from on the planet than anybody else. We're all ultimately equal. Do some of us have more intellectual intelligence than others? Unquestionably. Are some of us more gifted athletes or more gifted artists or musicians? Or do some of us have mental or physical challenges? No question about it. Of course there are ways that we differ and ways that each of us is superior and inferior to other people. But our ultimate worth is no different from one person to another. All of us. None of us has any greater right to enjoyment of life on the planet than anybody else. And nobody certainly has a right to decide who else is expendable or not. But there's some disturbing evidence to suggest that some people in positions of power believe otherwise, that they are above everybody else, and some of us are expendable to achieve their ends. And these are things we need to look at closely, become aware of, understand more and more precisely what really is going on, and look at the things we can do to heal these egregious wrongs in the world today. I want to move on to some questions people have sent in, and vaccine rights questions. This is Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. That's the title of the show. I get a question from time to time where people talk about vaccines required at birth and other birth procedures. And this is an interesting area because my own thinking has evolved in terms of legal analysis, has evolved in recent times on this very issue. The starting place, when someone says, why is it that my religious exemption doesn't apply to the vitamin K shot, you know, that our newborn son is supposed to get? And there's a whole battery of different procedures now that are required. Anywhere you give birth in the U.S., the newborn child is going to be required to get a whole list of different things. There's ointment they put in the eyes. There's a vitamin K shot. There's, of course, the hepatitis B vaccine. PKU test and some other things. It's been a long time since my children were born, so I don't remember the whole list, and I wouldn't be surprised if they keep adding things to that list like they keep adding vaccines to the vaccine list. But the question is, from the person who writes in, why doesn't my religious exemption to immunization apply to these other procedures? And there's sort of two parts to the answer. First of all, this is a state law issue, and every state has their own laws, and different states have different laws on this issue. So some states do have a statute or regulations that provide a religious exemption to all the newborn procedures. And what you do to exercise that just depends on whatever your state's law says. You might just have to write a statement, or you might have to explain your beliefs or whatever. In any event, whenever you're dealing with something that's outside of routine procedure, if you're going to refuse the hepatitis B vaccine or any of these other newborn procedures, you want to put it in writing that you have objections and what your objections are about. If there's a law that supports you, you probably want to cite the statute or regulation just to make sure the folks you're communicating to understand that you're not making something up, you're exercising a real right. And you want to make sure anybody involved has a copy of it way ahead of time, way before the birth, so that if anybody does have a difference of opinion or question, objection or anything, you can deal with that before the birth. Because the last thing you want to think about when you're dealing with giving birth to a child, or you're with your wife or partner giving birth to a child, is arguing with somebody about whether or not to do a procedure, because the state's require these procedures, and so the people who are attending the births and facilitating the birth, the healthcare professionals, their hands are tied at that particular point. They have to do what the law requires. Now, if you refuse, they're probably not going to get in a fist fight with you, but you'll create a very, potentially, a very negative experience and environment there. That's not what you want for yourselves, and especially not for a newborn child. anything and everything you can do to have those first moments, minutes, and hours of birth and afterbirth for a newborn to be as loving and tending and care, tender and caring as you can get them is the best thing in the world you can do for yourselves and your newborn child. So you want to deal with all this stuff ahead of time, get it clear, get it out of the way, get it in writing so everybody knows and everybody knows that everybody knows, so that there's not going to be any problem when you actually get to the birth. But the question, the more pertinent question is, that what about those people who are in states where there is not a law that says, here's your right to refuse these newborn procedures? And when there is a right, it's going to almost always be on religious grounds. So if you don't have a law saying, here's your right to refuse this vaccine or these newborn procedures on philosophical grounds, then you're going to have a hard time, I think, most of the time, getting anybody to cooperate with you. If you're just saying no from philosophical or personal beliefs, conscientious objections, what have you, any of those kind of things, all different ways of saying what is sometimes referred to as a philosophical exemption or objection. But if you have a non-medical, non-religious basis for objection, you're going to have a law on the books saying, here's your right to object on those grounds, or you have a very difficult time objecting. Because these folks on the other side, as I said, are probably legally required to administer all these procedures, and as far as they're concerned, their butt's on the line if they don't do them. So the question then becomes, if there's not a law that says, here's your right to religious exemption or some other kind of exemption to these procedures, is there any way to avoid them? And I used to tell people, no, I don't think there is. I think you really have to have a law because they're not legally required to, the state is not required under the Constitution to offer you a statutory exemption. That part I'm fairly clear of, although I don't know that even that's a point that's 100% clear in the law. But my thinking has evolved a little bit on this recently, and something along the lines of, I really don't think that you that the absence of an explicit right doesn't necessarily mean that there is no right. It may mean that if there's a right, it's going to be a little harder to exercise as a purely practical matter. But it doesn't necessarily mean absolutely that there is no right. So here's my thinking on this subject. There is a U.S. Supreme Court case, or Supreme Court cases, that have said that, in effect, parents can do pretty much anything they want to with their children based on religious beliefs up to the point where that causes or risks imminent harm to the child. So let me say that again, because we our First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution includes, among other things, what's called the Free Exercise Clause, and the Free Exercise Clause is about the free exercise of religion. And it's a very broad right for individuals and for parents with regard to their children. It's not an unbounded right, though, and there probably are few, if any, unbounded rights. But it's a very broad right. You know, you're not free to have a sacrifice a virgin every Saturday night because of your religious beliefs. I'm sorry, we just can't do that. So, and I'm being a little facetious there, but the point is that clearly, however broad freedom of religion is, clearly it's not an unbounded right, because that would give people an excuse to do anything and everything in the name of religion. Now, but if it's a true religious belief, in other words, if it's truly religious as opposed to philosophical or some non-religious belief, and if it's truly held, if it's sincere, if you're not just making it up so that you can achieve some goal, under a false pretense of religion, then it's a protected belief or practice protected by the First Amendment up to the point, as it pertains to parents and their kids, up to the point where it either causes or risks, poses an imminent risk of harm. Well, some states have these exemptions for newborn procedures, so clearly in some states they think it's okay for, you know, people to object on religious grounds. Do any of these procedures, are they implemented because of an imminent risk of harm? Let's look at the vitamin K, just as one example, because I'm not qualified to answer that question in the level of detail that I would like to be able to, but I can talk a little bit about the vitamin K as an example. When my oldest son was born many years ago, I asked the doctor about, hey, can we do oral vitamin K instead of injected vitamin K, because there was available at that time. I don't know if there still is or not, but you could get vitamin K that you give a child orally and not by injection. It just seems really rude to me that upon first entering the world that somebody would want to inject a child two or three times with the vaccine and vitamin K, and I think the PKU test is an injection, if I'm not mistaken, but it's don't hold me to that, folks. It's been many years since my youngest child was born. But in any case, it just seems like sort of a rude thing to do to somebody. You know, welcome to the world, jab. It just seems, and I say that not just as sort of a temporary discomfort, but that becomes part of the child's baseline experience for life in the physical world outside of the womb, you know, not a good foundation for what's to come after that. Maybe some of us who were held up and spanked after we were born and injected and circumcised and all these other things, maybe that's why so many of us as adults are all so crotchety all the time. We had such a really bad start. But in any case, my recollection from several years ago was that the reason you give vitamin K is because one out of about 250,000 newborns has some sort of a blood clotting problem, and that can lead to some complications, potentially, I think, probably even death. And so the doctors want to inject everybody with vitamin K. Now, you got to ask, when the odds of something are one out of a quarter of a million, are they doing that shot to protect themselves from liability, or are they doing it to protect your child from something that there's an extremely small chance of? But in any case, for purposes of our legal analysis, does lack of a vitamin K shot pose an imminent risk of harm? Not when the odds are one out of 250,000 that you're going to have a problem, or 200,000. It was some large figure on that order. So I think not getting a vitamin K shot pretty clearly does not pose an imminent risk of harm. And I suspect the other newborn procedures, while they're certainly done at least in part because they want to reduce the chance of having any sort of unavoidable problems, and the basic concept, at least as far as it goes there, is pretty good. But does that, is it, you know, are they to prevent conditions, or does the absence of those procedures pose an imminent risk of harm? Probably not. I think you could argue that. And therefore, you could say that if you have religious objections, you have a right, based on the Supreme Court precedent that interprets the First Amendment with regard to parental rights and children because of religious beliefs and practices, to refuse these newborn procedures. But I think in that instance, in the absence of a state statute or regulation providing it, I think you'd have to have an attorney write that up, make the legal argument, and submit that in advance to people so that if they had any problem with it, they can run it past their legal people and see whether or not you can reach an agreement on this. So you do potentially have that right, bottom line, whether or not there's a law giving it to you. But without a law giving it to you and making it clear for everybody, you may have a harder time exercising the right. You may need to involve an attorney to make that argument for you. Well, folks, we're nearing the end of our first half hour here. We're going to go to break for, I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes, something like that. This is vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. every Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern, noon Central, 11 Mountain, and 10 a.m. Pacific times. We come back on the other side. I am expecting my good friend and special guest, Rich Roberts, manager of the Pandemic Response Project, to join me for the next hour or so talking about some of the latest vaccine news. So, folks, I hope you will stay with us. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hey guys, Proof here. Guess what? I just got a cell phone. Hey, for everyone that knows me, I'm not a fan of cell phones, but I just signed up with a company called Solovay. And Solovay is offering a plan right now with unlimited phone, text, and web for only $49 a month. Plus, if you refer a friend or two, you get a discounted rate for everyone you refer, for as long as they have Solovay, not just for the first month, but for the whole time that person has Solovay. You sign up enough people, and Solovay pays you every month. What other cell phone company is going to pay you for service? Anyway, go to Solovay.com/freedomizer. That's Solovay, Solavei.com/freedomizer. Learn all about it. Plus, and another kicker, if you sign up three people under you, you'll get another month for free as well. Plus, they're going to pay you cash. Anyway, Solovay.com/freedomizer.
Oh, you want to heal the world? Oh, you can't do that. You know, you got to elect the right people. No, change your thinking. Change the way you feel. Change the way you do things. Do everything for peace. Like John Lennon said, walk for peace. You take a shower for peace. Do whatever you do for peace.
Every time you do that, you set a ripple effect out.
Because we live in a vibrational world, and your brain is the instrument. To learn how to direct and control your mind, you guys are superheroes. You know, they don't want you to know that, but you are. You guys are the most powerful people in the world.
We see the power in you to change your thinking. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday, only on Freedomizer Radio.
AntiWarTees.com is to promote anti-war activism, unlocking minds and shattering paradigms. By purchasing one of these t-shirts, you become an anti-war activist. www.antiwartees.com, bringing peace and human rights to the mainstream. Buy it, wear it, become it. Anti-war tees.
We are so pleased to announce ESP Botanicals is now sponsoring Freedomizer Radio. They have a bath and body line of products made for keeping your skin beautiful and healthy, but it's also for psoriasis, eczema, rosacea, and dermatitis treatment. They are meticulously prepared skincare products made from the best botanicals available. Committed to buying only from the growers when they can and using the highest quality cold-pressed oils, botanical organic additives, the best steam-expressed essential oils, and the least processed carrier oils that are available in today's marketplace. Pamper yourself for someone special in your life. Give the gift of beautiful, glowing skin. ESPBotanicals.com. Thank you so much for supporting us at Freedomizer Radio.
Please learn more about Freedomizer Radio by going to FreedomizerRadio.com and also Facebook us right at FreedomizerRadio.com. Catch you there.
We are Critical Immunity with Larry and Renee. Our show will cover current events, national health news, nutrition, emergency preparedness, and organic farming, and various implements and tools to thrive and survive. We hope you tune in and join in our discussion of health, liberty, preparedness, and survival. Join our hosts, Larry and Renee, with guest callers always welcome.
Tune in each Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Debbie Brooke, founder of Homeopathy World Community on Freedomizer Radio, talks about stress management and homeopathy. Get healthy with energy medicine.
Well, we are back. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips speaking to you from Asheville, North Carolina. Co-host Debbie Brooke from Homeopathy World Community is not with us today. She's traveling, but I am very pleased to say that filling in for Debbie, my good friend Rich Roberts, manager of the Pandemic Response Project. Rich, are you with us today?
I am. Good afternoon, Alan. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Rich. We always really appreciate it when you come in from time to time to fill in, and you always do such a terrific job of pulling out some terrific and important things to talk about, and you have keen insight as well into the issue, and we're delighted to have you. Just a real quick, I always do this, take advantage of when you're on, Rich, of taking a couple of minutes to explain the Pandemic Response Project, because you have been a just tremendous support for me in that project for the last, I guess, going on 3 years or so now.
back during the so-called swine flu pandemic of 2009-2010, I started getting lots of questions from people around the country asking, what do I do if they mandate this swine flu shot? And this was a new issue for me. Prior to that pandemic, I had not had occasion to look into and to recognize that our rights during a pandemic or state of emergency can change. And as I looked into that, as those questions came up to me, and I realized, wow, there are laws all over the U.S., and states around the country, almost all states have laws that if the state declares an emergency and mandates an emergency vaccine, the routine exemptions, the religious and philosophical exemptions, go out the window. And I've even seen a couple of laws that throw the medical exemptions out the windows in certain situations, and that's just mind-boggling to me. And if you refuse anyway, they probably can't physically hold you down and inject you, but I guarantee if people are in a panic, it's going to happen. We had at least one anecdotal incident of that during the 2009-10 swine flu pandemic that was reported. A high school boy in West Virginia was held down and given a swine flu vaccine over his objection and his mother's objection. I think they had a lawsuit there if they wanted to pursue it. I hadn't heard anything about whether or not they did, but a very disturbing situation. So even if and I think the law on this point is unclear, frankly, but even if it was unlawful, I think there are situations in an actual emergency when people are scared or in a panic where they're going to inject you, they'll hold you down and inject you, and then you can sue them later if you want to, because there's no way they're going to get this horrible disease if they're is one going around, or even the belief that one is going around. Because what we found during the swine flu pandemic is there really was no pandemic. I mean, the World Health Organization designated that as a level 6 pandemic, which is the highest level in their 6-level tier of pandemics. And it turned out that the swine flu was far less virulent than the regular seasonal flu. And it's not that the seasonal flu doesn't come with its complications. It certainly has some connections with deaths, particularly in the elderly, though usually they don't usually die from the flu. They die from other complications like pneumonia or something like that. But in any case, it's not saying the flu doesn't have any problems, but generally speaking, the seasonal flu is a pretty mild disease on the whole, and here was a swine flu that was far less virulent than even the seasonal flu, and yet it ended up with the highest level designation. Well, when they did that, it triggered contract clauses around the world for the sale of about $18 billion worth of vaccines, at least according to one European official. And even the British Medical Journal, a highly reputable, internationally respected mainstream medical publication, even the British Medical Journal criticized the World Health Organization for its fraudulent mishandling of the pandemic. So there were serious problems with the way the pandemic was played out and handled, and it certainly looks like in retrospect that it was all just a big money grab. Most of the vaccines produced were not even administered. The U.S. threw out $260 million worth of expired vaccines, and proportionally speaking, we were not throwing out the most. There were other countries who threw out a lot more than that. Anyway, the Pandemic Response Project is a project that I initiated with the goal of reforming state emergency health laws so that people have a right to refuse vaccines during a declared emergency. And if they're required to be quarantined, that they be given a right to choose any lawful location that they want to do the quarantine. And most particularly, if you want to do a quarantine in your home, you should be allowed to do a quarantine in your home. But as the laws sit right now in most states, they can mandate the vaccine, and if you refuse, they can quarantine you, and they get to decide where. No, you better come to our government facility. And I wasn't real big on any of the so-called conspiracy theories years ago. And some of the so-called conspiracy theories are not conspiracies. They're well-documented concerns. But I tell you, my imagination just wandered a little bit when I imagined a government pulling a bunch of people who refused to be vaccinated and putting them all in one government facility And it just seemed a little too convenient, that sort of a setting for me. Oops, you're all unvaccinated, and wouldn't you know it, a disease broke out amongst all of you because you were unvaccinated, and oops, you all died. See, we told you to get the vaccine. Call me paranoid on that one. You'd probably be right, but it just seemed like a potential setup that I just didn't want to see anyone be exposed to if there was any way to avoid that. So the answer I gave people once I started researching this, when they said, what do I do if they mandate the vaccine? My answer was, you do everything you can now to make sure you never end up in that situation, because I'm not sure what there is you can do if you get to that point. So, folks, we need to change the laws all over the country to give people the right to refuse emergency vaccines in a declared emergency, and the right to do a quarantine in our home or other appropriate lawful place of our choosing without being forced to get a vaccine, without being forced to do a quarantine in a government facility if we have a preference to do that somewhere else. So that is an enormous project, and we've made, I'm sorry to say, very little headway. We've made some headway on that here in North Carolina, but we haven't gotten the law all the way through. Rich, a little more long-winded than I had planned, but this is the project that I started, that you stepped up to support me in. Have always been and remain grateful to you for that. Welcome to the show today. You got anything on your mind here in terms of the recent news? And by the way, Rich and I both look, among other places, to the Pandemic Response Project website, which features a news page that's updated just about daily or close to it with vaccine news articles from around the country and around the world. So it's all three words spelled out, pandemicresponseproject.com, pandemicresponseproject.com, and then there's a news link at the upper right. Rich, what you got for us today?
Well, first off, Alan, thank you for that that summary of the Pandemic Response Project and bringing up a lot of old points there. But that was an excellent job, really, to say as much as you did that succinctly. And sadly, all that is still as important and pressing today as it was 3 years ago when we started that. Yes, beware of the declared phony emergency, and certainly nobody wants to be hauled off to government quarantine, you know. And I think you're right. That would be a setup, to say the least. To get all the people who refuse vaccination in one place, that would be a very bad plan for the non-vaxxers.
Yeah, but anyway, we got to understand too, Rich. Let me jump in. Excuse me for interrupting, but
okay,
I'm just
going
to jump in with one quick point here. We have to understand that it doesn't have to be a real emergency for
right.
your rights to change. What changes your rights is the declaration of an emergency, whether there really is one or not. And during the pandemic, 11 states declared state emergencies. Virginia declared a state of emergency without having documented a single case of swine flu anywhere in the state. And Obama declared a national emergency. And these declarations change our rights. There was a story recently that had from the pandemic, but had been working its way through the court system, I guess, and the story only came out recently, but a mother whose child was vaccinated with a swine flu vaccine at school over the mother's objection. Somebody made a mistake. And the fact that there had been a national declaration of emergency played into the mother's case being thrown out. I don't remember the details on it, but so we need to understand that once that declaration is made, whether it's a real emergency or not, the rights change. But please go ahead, Rich.
Okay. Well, I've got some articles to talk about here today. So why don't we start off? This is an interesting article that I found. this is from this is coming from the Healthy Home Economist. This is just says by Sarah. So I don't know if that's a last name or just a impartial name, but or incomplete name. But this article is called "Governor's Team with Hallmark to Pressure Parents to Vaccinate." And this caught my attention, Alan. I wasn't aware that this is going on, but 27 state governors from across the U.S. have teamed with Hallmark, and that is, of course, as you know, the greeting card company, to pressure parents to vaccinate children. And Hallmark has a program called For America's Babies, and this program is actually in its 18th year, so that part of it is not new, Alan. So I was a little surprised that, this has been going on so long. But basically what they do is they print personalized greeting cards for all new parents, and the greeting cards come with a detachable growth chart and also an immunization schedule. So what's changed now is that the cards are actually going to be mailed to newborns and their parents at the hospital from the state governors themselves in these 27 states. So it kind of puts a more authoritative touch on this process, Alan. And so that just kind of struck me. Why can't we get the governors to sort of, identify with the other side of this debate, And so it's just kind of a sad situation when stuff is just kind of rubber stamped like this, and these poor parents receive this kind of propaganda right at the baby's birth, Alan.
Well, there's an interesting thing that goes on in, I don't know if interesting is the right word or not, Rich, but interesting thing goes on in politics that politicians, perhaps necessarily, given the way the system has evolved and works presently, they have to be, well, I don't know if they have to or not, but they are concerned about image. What is going to look good? What is going to make them look good? What is going to get them reelected? What is going to make everybody happy or so forth? And that sort of is underneath that influence, at least, if not even the driving force. It's always an influence on anything they say or do. What's going to look good? It's a rare person who does the unpopular thing because it's right. And not that every right thing is unpopular, but we've had occasions in our nation's history where politicians have done the unpopular thing because they felt it was right, and whether I agree with them in any given case, I admire the person who can do that, because I think the vast majority of the time exactly the opposite happens. And the real reason they'll do something is because for their own reputation or to get reelected or to gain favor with industry, who's got the money to get them elected and reelected and so forth, all of that nonsense. But that's often what drives, what influences, if not drives what they do. And then on top of that, they'll put a veneer. And in this case, let's do something nice for America's babies, and whether it really is nice for America's babies is a separate question, but if they do that, of course, that's promoting the pharmaceutical industry and their profits, and so, of course, the pharmaceutical industry is going to be inclined to reward that with financial support, if not directly to the politician through some back door in an inappropriate, if not unlawful way, at least in the form of support for reelection or what have you. And it's a sad reality that politics, as opposed to science and law, politics is what drives policy and law far more often, in my opinion, but certainly in many instances, as opposed to what really is the right thing scientifically or otherwise. There's obviously a blatant conflict of interest any time a politician does something that promotes industry, or that even gives the appearance of promoting industry, because it immediately raises a question that can never be answered away, and that is, are you doing that really or in some part to help that industry, to gain favor or benefit, to get financial support from the industry? So we need well-known radio show host with Natural News Radio, Robert Scott Bell, said something, and I hope I'm not misquoting him, but the concept will be correct, something about the separation of vaccine and state, or separation of pharmaceutical industry and state. We really need to have a clear, sharp, bright red line between industry, private industry, and government. And In the healthcare arena, and vaccines in particular, we have exactly the opposite. We see all this partnering going on to see how many more vaccines we can get to how many more people, whether they need them or not, whether it injures or kills some or not. And you'll hear the fact of injury and death downplayed and even outright denied. Rich, I got to tell you this story. I had the privilege last week of doing a video interview with a couple of documentary folks from Australia. They're going around the country. These are professional documentary people, going around the country interviewing top people in the vaccine medical world and top players in the alternative vaccine community. And I was just, again, privileged and honored to for my name to have come up and for them to have included me in that. That was just a real feather in my cap. But it was real interesting. I won't give the name, but they were talking about a well-known, decades-long, well-known name in the mainstream vaccine world, a medical doctor at a prestigious university. And somewhere in the conversation with the documenters, they mentioned, the documenter mentioned something about the vaccine courts, and this doctor says there aren't any vaccine courts. And this guy's just like his jaw dropping to the ground. Well, no, of course there are vaccine courts. No, there aren't any vaccine courts. You know, how can somebody be a medical doctor in the world of vaccines and not be blatantly aware of the vaccine courts we have in this country? It's a division of the Federal Court of Claims. It's a court system that is specifically and exclusively a vaccine court system. They have what they call special masters who don't, they're like, they're the judges in these cases. They don't hear anything else other than vaccine injury cases. That's all they do. This whole division of our federal court system. How can any medical doctor any at all in the U.S. not know about that, let alone somebody who's a leader in the mainstream vaccine world? This is just mind-boggling. Was this doctor truly ignorant about it? Was he downplaying it? Who knows? But it's just disturbing. But let me reel myself back in here, Rich. The governor is supporting this, of course. On the surface, it's about we want to make sure all the babies get vaccinated so they don't get sick and die or whatever. And if that's truly what the governors believe, and it may be, then their heart's in the right place. But governors, does your letter to these parents also say, please also be advised that $100 million is paid out every year by the federal government, by the federal vaccine court system, to children and parents and other adults because of vaccine injuries and deaths. And by the way, FDA and CDC officials, as well as the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, have all said that something on the order of 90 to 99% of vaccine adverse events never get reported at all. So we really have no idea what the scope of the injury and death is. But we would like you, nevertheless, to get these vaccines. And by the way, there are exemption laws if you want to refuse them, but we want you to get these vaccines. And I just, you know, there's just no such thing as complete information coming from a governor to newborns about a vaccine for political reasons, not because it's not correct science or not because it's not correct information, but because the politics dictates otherwise. Now, honestly, Rich, in my best ability to give benefit of the doubt, I don't really see how you can remove politics absolutely from the political functioning. But we've got to find some way to keep it under control, minimize it if we eliminate it where we can, and minimize it if it can't be fully eliminated, because nobody's child should ever have to risk injury and death for the sake of pharmaceutical profit, or even if vaccines were completely safe and effective but still had these negative side effects, it should still be, for purely philosophical reasons, an option to exercise under complete information. Rich, we don't even require adults to serve in the military where they might have to risk their life in a war overseas. But we're requiring every newborn baby to risk his or her life for the presumed benefit to themselves and others. And we're asking more of our newborn infants than we are of our young adults turning 18 in this country, and for reasons and a cause that is far more dangerous than even serving in the military, I think.
Right.
But especially when you consider... Go ahead. I'm babbling a bit too much here.
Well, I do want to just kind of chime in about a couple of things that you said. You know, talking about the doctor not knowing about vaccine court. I agree that that's terrible, but it's probably typical, Alan, because I think a lot of people don't really know about the vaccine courts because that's really never the focus of, you know, mainstream media. It's almost as if they try to keep that secret, because knowing that those courts exist and knowing that that money exists for adverse events advertises the fact that there are adverse events, and they really, I think, try to play that down. And I likewise agree with, you know, your general sentiment that we have to separate the economic kind of push from the politics, especially like with Big Pharma, where we just have these conflicts of interest. We feel as if the tail's wagging the dog here. We have industry people telling the regulators who are supposed to be regulating them what to do, and all the laws are being made on behalf of profit, short-range profit. And sadly, a lot of the politicians are in on the profit, and you know, there's just a revolving door going back and forth between government and private industry, especially pharma. And so, yeah, this is a big part of the problem, is that the politics are tainted with kind of economics. So anyway, I did just want to say one more thing about this article, because you were making some pretty good jokes there, Alan, about what should potentially a letter like this say, you know, if it really wanted to be balanced. But here is actually what it does say. I wanted to read this to you because it's pretty ridiculous. This is from a letter in Florida, you know, that somebody received from the governor on a Hallmark card. And it says, "Congratulations on the birth of your new baby. As you grow together in family and community, we encourage you to build your baby's healthy imagination through reading and your baby's healthy life through immunizations." So there you have it, Alan. I know that kind of got a rise out of me, but they're kind of comparing the importance of immunizations to physical health to the importance of reading for imaginative health. So there you have it. Your shots are as fundamental as reading, Alan.
Well, I tell you what, if the parents would do reading first, they would come back and not do the second part there. So maybe there's a ray of hope in there that some of the suggestion of reading will wear off on the parents, and maybe they'll figure out if they do give that hepatitis B at birth, maybe they'll figure out that they don't want to do any more after that. But it's kind of crazy. Well, believe it or not, we've talked our way up to the next break. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips and the special guest, wonderful all-around human being and pandemic response project manager Rich Roberts. We'll take a break here for something on the order of around 4 or 5 minutes, and we'll be right back. We got lots more to talk about, folks. Don't go away.
You know the Constitution like the back of your hand. You've read books, listened to podcasts, attended lectures, surfed websites, and watched videos. You've made liberty your life's goal, but something seems to be missing. Stickers from LibertyStickers.com. Exercise your freedom of speech with the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. That's LibertyStickers.com. But wait. There's more. You can buy Liberty stickers wholesale. Get them for 99 cents each when you put 100 or more in your shopping cart in any combination. Sell them or give them away. They're great for gun shows, flea markets, fairs, outreach, and more. Earn extra money, promote freedom, and spread the word. Need custom stickers, labels, or decals for your organization or business? Liberty Stickers makes them. Go to LibertyStickers.com to order or call 877-873-9626. LibertyStickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers.
Get ready for the epic new documentary adventure ride of your life. Shade, the motion picture. A view into the globalist domain. And Embellus and Burma's film.
Nothing in this world works the way you think it does. Nothing. Governments do not operate the way you think they do. Banks do not do what you think they do. The police department is not here for what you think it is. Nothing in your world works the way you think it does.
We have to let them know that their world government has been identified, and they thought they just closed the world economy to bring in a worldwide police state, but instead it's going to bring them down.
You have to stand up, speak up, speak out.
See the motion picture. Order your copy of the DVD today at shadethemotionpicture.com.
Vaccines are required for students, employees, immigrants, military members, and international travel. Do you know how to legally avoid them? This is vaccine rights attorney and Freedomizer radio host Alan Phillips. My vaccine exemption ebook can help you avoid the mistakes that have cost others their exemption rights. Get the authoritative guide to vaccine legal exemptions, an ebook available at freedomizerradio.com and vaccinerights.com.
Let freedom ring throughout the land.
Hello everyone, Proof here again. I want to let you know about our brand new sponsor, Silver Leaf Tea. Now as you guys know that have listened to me for years, I am a tea aficionado. I have hundreds of different flavors and styles at my house, and Silver Leaf has exactly the kind of stuff that I look for. I love loose tea, great antioxidants, I just love the taste of it, and this Silver Leaf has black, they have green, they have white, they have organic. Great for hot tea and iced tea. Silver Leaf Tea, it's right on our website, freedomizerradio.com. And check it out and order it. Silver Leaf Tea.
Hey there, Freedomizers. This is JC from the Sports Lounge. Join us for 3 hours on Saturdays as we take a break from politics to discuss sports at freedomizerradio.com. Come and join us each Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon Pacific, noon to 3 p.m. Eastern.
I was once out strolling one very hot summer day.
Lindsay Williams on Freedomizer Radio.
Proof Negative, I love the title that you use on your radio. I've thought about it ever since we talked on off of the air the other day, and I'd say that that's an excellent title for a talk show host.
Hey, Freedomist, join me, Proof Negative, weeknights, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Pacific, as we fight the New World Order together, right here on Freedomizer Radio, your exclusive home of the Proof Negative Show.
Hey man, this is the Rasta man, smoking the big fat spliff and listening to the mouth on the Last Voice for Liberty Network. Lord have mercy.
Well, we are back. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. I tried to throw in a couple other promotional ads there because the mowers were going right outside my window here, so hopefully they're... finished with the nearby section here, but if you hear some rumbling come in over the next couple of minutes, that's probably what it is. Rich, let's, boy, there's many, many, many more topics here to talk about. Let's push on to another one. What else you got for us today?
Okay, well, let's take a look at another article. This one is from RT, and this is entitled Top Scientist to Obama, Ban Mutation Experiments That Will Make Avian Flu More Infectious. And I don't see an author on this article. But anyway, the gist of the article is a group of scientists, and this includes a Nobel Prize winner, have proclaimed that it's ethically and morally wrong to alter the deadly H5N1 virus to make it more contagious for research purposes. And they've asked the president to ban it. So I'm sure you've been kind of following this controversy, Alan, that... folks in the laboratory are continuing to screw around with these flu viruses and are basically trying to experimentally weaponize them under the guise of, you know, learning more about how they mutate, et cetera. Let me see if I can find
it. What do you think about this, Rich? Because I think this is a legitimate philosophical question here. I mean, you know, just sort of playing devil's advocate. I mean, if we don't develop it, and then how can we learn to defend against it? And if we don't do that, I mean, aren't other people going to be developing it? It's sort of like if we don't develop the old argument of, we don't develop the nuclear bomb first, isn't somebody else going to develop it, and then they're going to rule the world? And
well, certainly, you know, we can argue this, and that's actually one of the scientists here working with this is quoted Ron Fauchier from Erasmus Medical Center in the Netherlands, and basically he is saying that the virus is going to change itself without the lab, and so if the lab can make these mutations, that maybe they can foresee its progression sooner, and that might help them develop vaccinations or cure sooner. So, I mean, personally, I think that I don't go along with that way of thinking, because, you know, they're going to force mutations in the laboratory that you really can't prove that that was going to happen in the natural realm, for one thing. And even if it was going to happen, it would be a much slower progression. Plus, I just think we have general kind of questions of not being able to trust, you know, some of our kind of scientific think tanks operating in conjunction with the government and military. And so the last thing I think we want is these kind of mad scientists tinkering with these sort of flu viruses and making them, you know, much more deadly and much more kind of airborne and much more easily spread between humans. So anyway, I mean, I guess we have one group of scientists defending it and wanting to go on with this research, Alan, but, you know, the whole gist of this article is that a group of scientists, including a Nobel Prize winner, have kind of went public with this, and they're warning Obama to ban this experimentation. So my particular view is that this is bad science. This is Nazi science. So
yeah, I mean, the thing that jumps out at me as I'm listening to you talk about both sides here is that when you go experimenting, there, by definition, experiment is an exploration. There are going to be things that happen that you didn't intend.
That's
and
right.
It's sort of like, and this is this, the GMO issue is so much more multifaceted than the example I'll give, but it's sort of like the GMO thing where you grow, you know, some GMO crops in one field, and oops, they pollinate another non-GMO field, and suddenly those are GMO crops now too. And it's these sort of unintended effects that once it's out in the world, there's nothing you can do about it. Now, of course, you know, they're going to say they're going to use all these extreme safety protocols. It'll all be self-contained. It's not like somebody's going to develop the evil virus and then, you know, expose the world to it and kill all of humanity. The problem, though, as you allude to in your other comment, is we don't know who's going to do what and how, who is vulnerable to doing what when they're offered how much money or what have you. You know, human beings are human, as the saying goes, and they make mistakes or they do bad things. I'm not saying any particular, you know, U.S. or other scientist is vulnerable to that or not in any manner or degree. It's not an accusation about any specific scientist or scientist in general. It's a comment about history, frankly, and human beings generally, that we will, in the process of doing research, things happen that you don't intend. And if you're creating virulent strains, what, however great or remote the possibility is, there is something that can potentially be unleashed, whether deliberately or accidentally. If you don't go there in the first place, you don't run any of those risks. And we heard the same kind of stuff from nuclear power plants. Well, I mean, the nuclear power plants, my gosh, if something goes wrong, look at the horrible, horrible catastrophe you can have on your hands that we will not see cleaned up for generations, if not hundreds or thousands of generations. Some of the nuclear waste products have half-lives in, literally in the millions of years. You know, you're talking about, for all practical purposes, destroy an entire part of the planet if you have a severe catastrophe with a nuclear power plant. And, of course, what we hear is, oh, we've got all these safety controls in place. That can never happen. But then we have
right.
Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, Fukushima. It does happen. And these, you know, three major incidents just off the top of my head, and it's not an isolated instance when it's just the one fluke instance, you know, when it's not just one fluke instance. But even a fluke instance, if it's severe enough, is something to avoid altogether by not even creating the remote possibility. So it sounds really, really problematic to me that they would want to go forward with this. Now, I'm sure there are some pressing motivations for going forward. Money, profit, rule the world, all that kind of thing. You come up with the killer disease, you know, and you probably could rule the world if you had the right group of people behind you on it, you know. So, but, no, I mean, and there is some logic to the idea if we don't develop it now and be prepared for it when it happens naturally. But mutation, I don't think you can predict what in advance what a mutation will be and how it will play out. And it's not like, well, we have to mutate it, you know, artificially before it happens naturally so that when it happens naturally we're ready for it. I have to get a scientist on to talk to that one, but I doubt that you can predict in advance what the next mutation is going to be so that you can prepare for it. I think you have to see those things when they occur and then take, you know, prop steps accordingly. So it troubles me. I'm with the folks who are saying let's not mess with this. But you know, Rich, there is probably so much going on that we have no idea is going on, and I think the powers that be, if they want this to happen, it'll happen whether Obama says it can or not. It's just a matter of do we do it with government's blessing or do we do it covertly, because there are things that even the president isn't even allowed to know, disturbingly,
right,
that go on in and out of government. So it'll happen probably one way or the other. The question simply is, will it happen with a public blessing or not?
Right, and that's so true, that this sort of thing has, you know, for all we know, been going on covertly now for decades, and who knows that this is just not more fear-mongering and kind of setting the stage to have excuses, you know, for the time where biological agents are kind of used against populations. But anyway,
or even as a disinformation, if Obama takes a position and says, no, you can't do that, then everybody says, oh, I feel safe, it's not happening, when maybe it's really going on anyway. Let me bring in just as sort of a close analogy, because I saw a YouTube video just in the last day or so. It was as fascinating as it was disturbing. And it was about a report that said the FBI had foiled another terrorist attack before it happened. And, you know, let's praise the FBI for doing this. But it turns out that this was a bomb attack that didn't take place. But it turned out to be one that the FBI created, and they created the bomb, and it was the FBI's vehicle that was used in this event. And in fact, every part of this was created and devised and implemented by the FBI, except they went out and found someone who turned out to be someone with some mental health problems, and they talked this person into participating in this, and then they end up prosecuting this person. And of course, if you're prosecuted successfully for terrorism, they throw away the key, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that somebody who goes along with something like that is a good person. Don't get me wrong. But, I mean, are we so hard up for finding terrorism that we have to actually invent it and then find susceptible people that we can talk into participating so we can prosecute them and say, look, we got a terrorist, and pat ourselves on the back? I mean, I think all the FBI folks who were involved in that are co-conspirators. I think they should all go to jail, too.
It's
fundamentally wrong to me.
That's acting in bad faith, and we've been seeing that constantly now, Alan, that almost every single instance, you know, that I'm aware of where there's been a recent arrest on terrorism charges, it is the FBI or the CIA behind the scenes that is drafting the individual and funding them and giving them the so-called weapons. You know, a lot of times they give them a fake bomb or something, and then they kind of send them out to do, you know, to execute the plan that the FBI themselves have kind of come up with, and then they kind of bust them. And so it's acting in bad faith, and it's fear-mongering in my mind. It's, you know, they build up this sort of huge public fear of terrorism, and it's a complete boogeyman. And so I think they're just afraid we're going to catch on to the fact that, you know, there aren't radical terrorists behind every tree, and so they do everything that they can to engineer these events and create them and then sort of pose as our saviors. So it's sad, and so I do think this kind of research parallels that. It's just operating in bad faith in my mind, and there's more misuses that can come out of this than good uses. So that's an interesting example.
Yeah, it just seems I've seen this in other areas, and I don't want to get off topic here, but I've seen this in other areas too, where people lure someone who's susceptible of being lured into doing something unlawful so that they can prosecute them. Again, I'm not saying the person who gets lured into this is a good person. They're not. But if they haven't actually, if someone, just because somebody could commit a crime doesn't mean you can lock them up. You can only lock them up if they actually do commit a crime. And if you didn't lure that person, would they ever have been a terrorist in this instance? Who knows? Maybe. But they certainly wouldn't have at the time that they did when they were lured in. So it's like, you know, if we have to manufacture terrorists in order to prosecute terrorists and in order to pat ourselves on the back and say, look, we're stopping terrorism. I mean, under the right circumstances, there's all kinds of things that any of us would do. And it seemed the article was focusing on the fact that this particular person had, you know, mental health problems, and almost like they're preying, it's almost like they're singling out the people who are, because of their mental health problems, perhaps susceptible to being manipulated into participating in a crime, you know.
Well, exactly. Almost every time it's like that. The people that, you know, anybody who would agree with something like this is deranged by definition. And so, yeah, they look for weak-minded people, people who lack capacity, and they basically mislead them into these kind of stunts and then prosecute them. So it's really sad. very
well,
sad.
Let's push on. You know, there was I don't know if you saw this particular article or not, one that a schoolgirl in, I think it was in West Virginia, got it says Staten Island kindergartner, banned from school because she didn't get the chickenpox vaccine, and the doctor recommended that she not get the chickenpox vaccine because it would pose a risk to her infant baby sister, the health of the baby sister. And this is a disturbing thing to me, because I joke with my clients, and it's really kind of dark humor in a sense, where I say some state laws are written in such a way that even if a doctor recommends a medical exemption, the state has the authority, and this varies from state to state, but in New York it's true, they have the authority to basically overrule, so to speak, the doctor's recommendation for a medical exemption, because everybody knows that a bureaucrat sitting at a desk in the state capitol knows more about your children than your doctor, than your children's pediatrician. And, you know, that's the, if you can call it humor part of it, but it's kind of sick humor in a sense, because the idea is so preposterous on its face that somehow a politician has to have authority to overrule a doctor's medical opinion. Now, is it possible that occasionally a doctor would recommend a medical exemption where the doctor truly didn't think it was warranted because they were friends of the parent or wanted to keep the parents as a client, as patients or clients, or for whatever reason? Of course, that's always a possibility anywhere in life. But to presume as a starting place that doctors are going to function necessarily that way, and therefore we have to, as a starting place, give the state authority to overrule a doctor's opinion is, I don't know, it's just absurd to me. It's just absurd. So it's so sad that there's a situation like this. Does it strike you similarly or different? How does that hit you, Rich?
Well, it does. I saw that article too, Alan, and to me it was sad on many different levels. First of all, it sounded like, you know, I don't know if it was official, but it sounded like the young girl had a medical exemption. And second of all, I mean, chickenpox is such a benign childhood illness anyway. I mean, as you know, a lot of more liberal-minded folks literally have chickenpox parties where, you know, they expose their children to children with chickenpox just so they can go ahead and kind of get this process out of the way, so to speak. So to think that a little girl, you know, gets kicked out of school for something like this. And I guess my question is, Alan, I didn't realize that chickenpox had really came on as one of the so-called mandatory vaccinations now for going to school. Is that accurate, that that's really one of the vaccines that all little kids are getting now?
The chickenpox vaccine is one of the more recent ones. I think it was developed in the early 90s and somewhere came out in the early 90s, if I remember correctly, and somewhere shortly after that, states slowly began adding it to the required schedule. Now, every state has their own state laws about what vaccines are required and what exemptions are available, but so I can't say, you know, off the cuff that every state absolutely mandates chickenpox vaccine, but probably most, if not all of them, do at this point. And it's interesting because the chickenpox vaccine, when it first came out, it was not marketed as a vaccine to save people from the horrors of chickenpox, because there aren't horrors of chickenpox. It has literally a 99.9999% recovery rate. You probably have a better chance of being struck by lightning than you do of dying from chickenpox. It's just a common benign disease. When the chickenpox vaccine first came out, it was promoted as, hey, look, parents, give your kids this vaccine and you don't have to stay home for a week when your kid gets the chickenpox. It was purely a money-saving vaccine. By this,
right,
you can avoid staying home, you know, on short notice for a week with a sick child. And now, of course, it's promoted as save your child from this horrible disease, chickenpox, which, you know, can kill you and cause you to have shingles later in life and whatever other things they throw in there. The problem is that now shingles, which used to be a disease that almost exclusively affected people over 50, is now affecting kids. We have children and teenagers and young adults getting shingles from the vaccine. They've gotten the vaccine, and all of a sudden we're seeing shingles explode in the pre-50 population, where it was virtually non-existent before the vaccine. So, you know, is it really worth having a potentially debilitating side effect like that? And the chickenpox vaccine has the same risk, you know, generally speaking, of injury and death that any other vaccine has. And when you administer millions of vaccines, you're going to have permanent disabilities and death. It's just a given, unfortunately, in today's world. So the idea that, though, that a doctor doesn't get to have the final say, I guess, is disturbing to me. Maybe there should be a procedure where, if there's reason to believe, objective reason to believe, the doctor is being disingenuous, you know, is faking it for some inappropriate reason, well, yeah, let's you know, have the ability to challenge dishonesty anywhere and everywhere it exists, that it at least where it poses a significant risk of harm or injury to somebody, but not in something having to do with the chicken pox. You know, come on, give me a break.
Let me bring up this point on this article, Alan. It says that the doctor refused to vaccinate the child with the chicken pox vaccine on the grounds that it would endanger the health of the baby sister. Now, is the doctor making the point that the vaccine itself and the older sibling would expose the younger sibling to the virus? I mean, is that the logic? I mean, in that case, with that logic, wouldn't we kind of basically not want to give anybody the chickenpox vaccination?
It would be a question of degree, and it may be a risk that some doctors feel is a legitimate concern and others feel isn't. One of the things, you know, the chickenpox vaccine is a live viral vaccine, and I remember when they were switching to the live viral polio vaccine many years ago, one of the things they were saying, this is actually great because it's a live virus and it'll be shedding for some period of time, a couple weeks or whatever, after you administer the vaccine, and this will vaccinate other people who come into contact with the child, whether they get the vaccine or not. And isn't that wonderful? You know, we don't even have to vaccinate everybody for everybody to get vaccinated.
No, and yet,
what we found is that in a small percentage of instances, a child or baby gets a polio shot, and then the adult develops paralytic polio from the vaccine virus.
Right.
And we've had documented instances of this. And, you know, they always defend it and justify it after the fact. Oh, it's already happened, so we better come up with an explanation for it so that everybody is okay with it. Well, the benefits outweigh the risks here. You know, yes, a few people are sacrificed on the pharmaceutical vaccine altar for the safety of all the millions of people whose lives have been saved. And I don't want to go off on a tangent here with polio because we got some other great articles to get to, but I just want to mention, because it's so important to repeat this, that polio actually increased when the first polio vaccine was introduced, following a 5-year natural decline, by the way, and that increase was covered up by redefining polio on paper. Polio originally included what we now statistically record as three separate viruses that are called polio, aseptic meningitis, and Coxsackie virus, but prior to the introduction of the vaccine, those were all statistically recorded as polio. And you look at the official statistics after the introduction of the vaccine, you see polio rates drop. But if you look at the aseptic meningitis and Coxsackie virus rates, they skyrocketed at the same time. And we had a professor of biostatistics from the University of North Carolina, right here in our home state, Rich, who testified in 1962 before Congress that not only did the polio vaccine not work, it actually backfired, it reversed.
Right.
And this is so disturbing that we had this formal level of exposure of deceit and fraud by the public health authorities of the time covering their own butts. And yet today, we still are all taught, and most of us come to believe that polio is this wonderful thing, that the polio vaccine was this wonderful thing that saved us all from polio, and, you know, end of story, and that's why vaccines are all wonderful, because the polio vaccine saved us all from polio, and that's just not what happened.
Well, I guess that's one of the most frustrating things about doing this activism, probably any activism, Alan, is once something gets out there in the collective mind, whether it's true or false, and especially now when it's backed up by this kind of media machine, it's just so hard to change those perceptions. And so, you know, we have high-level officials, like you're saying, talking about the polio vaccine and how it was really counterproductive and gave people polio, just like in India now. They've renamed sort of a similar disease that appears related to the vaccination. Instead of, you know, that kind of getting some traction and waking people up, you know, we're still dealing with a situation where, you know, state governors are sending greeting cards to newborns' parents asking them to be vaccinated, you know, polio and other dangerous vaccines. So it's like, what does it take to kind of change the perception on this and get people en masse to kind of start seeing some of these things that we're talking about?
Well, you know, that's what we're doing right now today on the radio, Rich, is we're continuing to speak our truth. And hopefully this will get out to more and more people. And because it's really going to take a serious and organized speaking out. And I don't think it necessarily takes a majority of people, but it's going to have to be people who speak loud enough that we get heard everywhere, of course, that it's important to be heard. And, you know, wake enough people up, get people to understand that, yes, these things really do happen. There really have been some very serious, have been and are very serious problems in the world, and we need to take steps to heal the planet, you know, heal these problems.
And just going back to this little girl, you know, in New York who's been booted out of kindergarten, and I don't know what the status is with it now, but, you know, it's my sincere hope that as some of these families and children, you know, are bullied about by the school system over this and similar issues, Alan, that people will start to see that the school system's kind of caught up in this. And I think a lot of people might find that they will be better off without the school system. You know, not everybody can do this, but homeschooling, I think, could be a good option and might go a long way toward re-educating the next generation, or not allowing, you know, the next generation to kind of fall into a lot of this propaganda. But you know, so I hope these families do consider that when they put up with this phony stuff from the school system.
Boy, we could do a whole
I know, we could go off
talking
on
about
that.
The school systems, but as you know, Rich, I'm a full-time single parent, and it's just not an option to homeschool my kid. And I wish I lived near you, and I just drop him off at your house every morning. But really wish I could do that. I think there are a lot of wonderful people in the public school system who want to do the right thing and the good thing, but the system is a system, and ultimately limited necessarily in some ways, and ultimately to one degree or another controlled by a small number of people, the curriculums. And there certainly is the potential, if not the temptation, to use that to achieve particular political ends. And if we had less systemization of the school systems, more locally grown, so to speak, we might see a more diverse and truthful representation of, and more neutral teaching of facts and skills and abilities. But don't get me started. I was so proud of myself. We got to my son went to a new school this year because we moved last summer, and I got 3/4 of the way through the year before I had an event happen that was just too much for me to turn the other way on, and so find myself again in conflict with the school system and wishing I could homeschool. But we've got to go to a break here. And you're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips, normally with co-host Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Bruck. Debbie Bruck is traveling this week, and so filling in for Debbie, my good friend and pandemic response project manager, Rich Roberts. And my system just twisted around in front of me here. I'm going to see if I can pull it together here and get the right ads running for you here, folks. We'll be back in about 4 to 5 minutes, and we've got the better part of a half hour left to go, so don't go away.
Does the media ever deceive the public?
A white plane, a very big jet, was flying an unusual pattern near the White House over Lafayette Park. Very slowly, it made one circle, and then...
Are the media and their sources trustworthy?
New York State and New Jersey will get their first doses of the swine flu vaccine.
The H1N1 virus has made thousands of people across the country sick. Many have died. And some worry that it could grow into a full-blown pandemic.
Where does our mainstream media get their news? All this enjoyment is brought to you by all the things sweetened with NutraSweet.
There's a reason why we want to own these guns.
We're going to have to come together and take meaningful action to prevent more tragedies like this.
That was President Obama Friday suggesting it is now time to reopen the national debate on gun control.
The media tends to march in lockstep with the government.
Who is responsible when the media fabricates the news?
When the public is constantly fed messages that are potentially leading us into a war that may not be necessary, it's not fair to the American people, and it's not fair to journalism, because the truth isn't being told here. We found out that CNN International is actually making money from the Bahrain regime. They are a customer of Bahrain. Bahrain is paying CNN International to create content that shows Bahrain in a favorable light, to then air that content on CNN International.
Join us online at williamlewisfilms.com. That's williamlewisfilms.com.
Hey guys, Proof here. Guess what? I just got a cell phone. Hey, for everyone that knows me, I'm not a fan of cell phones, but I just signed up with a company called Solavay. And Solavay is offering a plan right now with unlimited phone, text, and web for only $49 a month. Plus, if you refer a friend or two, you get a discounted rate for everyone you refer for as long as they have Solavay, not just for the first month, but for the whole time that person has Solavay. You sign up enough people, and Solavay pays you every month. What other cell phone company is going to pay you for service? Anyway, go to solavei.com/freedomizer. That's Solavei, SOLABEI.com/freedomizer. Learn all about it. Plus, and another kicker, if you sign up 3 people under you, you'll get another month for free as well. Plus, they're going to pay you cash. Anyway, solavei.com/freedomizer.
When tyranny rears its ugly head, will you bow and serve, or will you stand and fight?
Hi, everybody. This is Barack Obama.
Who gets this hunger?
Everybody here wants the pie. We want to grow the pie, and then we want to fight for the pie.
When freedom is threatened, will you turn a blind eye, or will you sound the alarm?
The private sector is doing fine.
Hey folks, this is The Mouth, host of The Last Voice for Liberty Network. Tune in Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Pacific, 11 Central for your ultimate dose of liberty right here on FreedomizerRadio.com.
What can we get done right now?
What?
This is the politics of the moment. This has to do with what can we get done right now?
What?
This is the politics of the moment. This has to do with what can we get done right now?
We know about the Gulf oil spill. We know about problems with voting. We know about environmental toxicity. We know that there are problems about the wars, that our government is not representing the people as we would wish them to represent us. But we also know that there are crystal clear solutions. I'm Patricia Springstead, and I'm heavily involved in making the world a better place.
Every day you try to brainwash people, just to have things go your way.
Trisha Springstead on Freedomizer Radio. Crystal clear solutions.
Well, tell me, what you gonna do when your well runs dry?
Rob Nellen Live is a show exposing the fallacy of the right-left paradigm while promoting liberty and freedom. A plethora of guests will challenge the establishment, mainstream media, the New World Order, and hopefully you. Listen to Rob Nellen Live Sundays between 3 and 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time right here on the Freedomizer Radio Network.
We are back. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips and special guest manager of the Pandemic Response Project, Rich Roberts. Rich, are you still with us?
I'm still here, Alan.
And I'm hoping you've got another 15 to 20 minutes you can spend with us today to finish out the second hour. We've got, I tell you, I keep thinking, how are we going to fill the time up? You know, we can't possibly spend more than a couple minutes explaining this or that, and we end up getting to far less than I thought we would do. But let's move on to a couple more topics here, and because there's just a lot of different things going on in the news here.
Okay. Well, let's take a look at another article. This one is from the Sleuth Journal, and this is entitled, "Who Suspends Vaccine After 26 Children Die?" So, according to reports, 26 children have died in various countries now, Alan, and this is following their receipt of a 5-in-1 vaccine, pentavalent vaccine, called Quinvaxin. And, you know, even the name of that vaccine sounds evil, Alan. I mean, it's just so straightforward. Quinvaxin, as in, like, vaccine, like, you know what I mean? It's like, it's almost like Vaxxum almost translates as eliminate them or something. But anyway, this vaccine has been offered at no cost by UNICEF, and it was being given to babies as young as 8 weeks of age. And so this was for diphtheria, tetanus, whooping cough, hepatitis B, and a particular influenza type as well. But anyway, 26 children have died, and then finally, you know, who has suspended the vaccine? And local authorities, you know, have suspended all the batches for testing. It says here, however, the health ministry said there's no problem with the vaccine's quality or distribution. So it seems as if there's still disagreement, Alan, between the local kind of officials and the more national officials. But the countries in which some of these children were dying, there was kind of a list here. They were dying in Vietnam, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Bhutan, and India. Okay, and apparently this vaccine had passed some sort of safety protocols in South Korea. So anyway, we have multiple children dying in multiple countries from this Quinvax vaccine. So just another kind of horrible tale of the damage being done worldwide by these things. And you know, Alan, you know, when you follow this subject and you read the alternative literature, I mean, it's quite common that we see articles like this. And, you know, I've probably reported on half a dozen articles of, you know, numerous children dying in other countries as a result of vaccinations. And yet, you know, how often do we hear this in the mainstream news? How often have I ever even seen an article like this show up on CNN, or if I just turn on my local news station? So anyway, very discouraging stuff, and it does seem as if perhaps some of these batches of vaccines in foreign countries are a little hotter than maybe what we're being exposed to here in the United States, and I don't really know how to account for that. The author of this particular article pulls no punches and suggests, you know, that the WHO needs to stop pretending to be concerned about children's safety and admit they're in on, like, a worldwide genocide scheme. But, you know, when you see the damage that these vaccines do and you really kind of follow it, it doesn't seem so far-fetched, Alan.
Well, you know, there's so many points in there, Rich, and let's just touch on them so we can get to hopefully at least one or two more articles here. But the idea that the children can die and, you know, okay, something went wrong, and that's all that happens.
Right.
You know, that any one child's life is expendable in the name of a pharmaceutical agenda, in the name of protecting, you know, all the people whose reputations and jobs are in the way. I mean, children die. Somebody should, if they can't prove that that was absolutely unavoidable, I mean, there should be people's careers and freedom should be on the line here. You know, somebody, there's no way that you can compensate somebody for the death of their child.
There's no way
you can compensate that lost child for his or her own death. And the fact that this can happen and there aren't people losing jobs and going to jail is just a fundamental concept or principle to me here, is just disturbing. And yet this happens all the time. It happens over and over again. You know, you fill in on this show. You're not a regularly scheduled guest, and yet you're talking about how it's like every time you're on, Rich, however infrequent it is, you're talking about, you know, one or more articles. Well, here are people who have died from vaccines in a foreign country somewhere, and sometimes here in the U.S. And somehow all of this ultimately gets swept under the rug. It gets swept under the media rug, as you say, because you don't ever hear about this on mainstream media. And somehow it all just gets swept under, you know, well, it's just, you know, third world people. They don't count. I mean, I don't know what the mentality is here.
I know. There's no accountability at all, and I wonder how, you know, international law comes into it, and I'm sure it's so complicated, and I don't mean to get you off on that, but it just seems like it's easier for Big Pharma to get away with this in some of these third world countries than it would be for them to get away with it in the U.S., although they're getting away with murder here, too. But this stuff just seems really bad, and you're right. There is no accountability.
I want to underscore, and I'm not a criminal law attorney, so I'm not saying this as a formal legal opinion or legal advice, and we don't give legal advice on the air. We talk about legal principles sometimes, and we certainly don't give medical advice in any formal sense. But I'm going to talk in sort of general terms here, but I don't think the word murder, when you use it there, was metaphorical, Rich, because we now have proof that officials here in the U.S. know that, for example, that vaccines cause autism. They know the vaccines are causing injury. Now, of course, they know it because the federal government here pays $100 million a year to victims and their families. And yet, somehow this is all rationalized, that it's okay because it's a necessary cost that we as a society pay. Where is the logic in that, that we can regard a human life as something that you spend in order to get, you know, some presumed result? Let's go, let's see, I don't know, let's, what do you say we spend, what can we get for 400 human lives? What can we get for that? Let's see, well, we could, no, if no, that's not enough to really get anything. If we, if you're willing to spend 3,000 or 4,000 lives, and if you dress them up in military uniforms, you can get rights to oil in other countries. So, you know, let's talk about this, because this is the calculation that has to be made by the military in terms of you know, going to war, by the federal and state politicians and health authorities in terms of vaccines and healthcare policy. So how many lives are you willing to spend in order to ensure the pharmaceutical profits continue and expand, not just continue, but continue to expand? Well, let me see. I think it's probably worth, you know, 10,000 or so infant lives a year. I think it's worth that. And there have been estimates in the past that as many as 10,000 children die from vaccine-related causes that are almost always written off as SIDS, which is a catch-all category where anything, if you don't know why they died, you throw it into the SIDS category and call it SIDS. So SIDS is not a, this is what happened in any sort of precise way. SIDS is a, we don't know what happened, so we'll just call it this. And people really need to understand that. SIDS is not a definitive diagnosis in the sense that it says here's a mechanism that occurred and there was nothing we could do about it. SIDS is where you put all those infant deaths that you don't know why they died, or you don't want to admit why they died, you don't want to find out why they died, so we'll just call it SIDS, and then we've got a label to put it in and everybody's okay.
Right.
Well, we're not all okay with that, but sorry to, you know, shake your cage, folks, but some of us are not okay with that. But I digress here.
And as you know, Alan, you know, a great majority of the SIDS deaths occur immediately after the DPT vaccination. So there's a strong argument that can be made that there's a direct correlation there.
Yeah, well, there is a very direct correlation. Dr. Vera Scheibner, it's either Scheibner or Scheibner, and I apologize to her for my lack of clarity on that. But she wasn't even looking at vaccines or for a vaccine issue. She was monitoring infant breathing rates and found quite unintentionally that there was a direct correlation between the administration of vaccines and a weeks-long pattern of changes in infant breathing. And she found that the breathing went through cycles. There were periods at predictable times in terms of duration, you know, number of days from the vaccine, where the breathing became highly erratic. So this actually fell into a predictable pattern. And at these times, I think there was one period around 2 weeks out from a vaccine and another maybe on the order of 30 days, and where there were these intense irregular breathing, predictable breathing times, there were clusters of so-called SIDS deaths. And she concluded from her research that probably half or more of, I think it was something like half of so-called SIDS cases are really vaccine deaths.
Right.
And there's been some other research looking at vaccines and SIDS that got brushed under the table real quick. When it finally becomes widely recognized and accepted that people have deliberately suppressed information that could have saved countless infant, baby, toddler, and children's lives, there are some people who are probably going to be victims of some pretty horrific anger. I don't know how those people who did that, they better not have their, you know, address in any publicly available information. I'll put it like that. Now, I'm not recommending anybody do anything illegal or improper, but I'm just saying, you know, if my child died And I learned later that somebody knew that the death could have been avoided, but they hid information that could have avoided it. I'm not sure, you know, what I would do in that situation. I'm not sure, you know, if I'm not sure what I do. And there are people who probably would resort to inappropriate responses. Because, I mean, some people have referred to this as genocide, and my first thought about it is, come on, I mean, that's a bit of a radical, extreme word for it. Well, maybe it's not, because at least the spirit of the word, I think, applies here. You've got children internationally who are getting vaccines, being injured and killed because they are reasonably following the information they're getting from federal and international health authorities, who are relying on information that is incomplete and deliberately devoid of the information that says what the true risks are.
Right.
And, I mean, I think that's criminal in nature, if not literally criminal in terms of a prosecutable crime. I'm not a criminal law attorney. I can't speak to that specifically. But I'll tell you, in general concept, as a parent, that's criminal behavior.
Well, I agree that it's criminal. And the really horrible thing about it, Alan, as you know, is we're probably only seeing such a small piece of it above the surface. You know, for every child, you know, we hear about dying, you know, there's probably so many others who are damaged, who it's not reported, that we really can't put cause with effect. You know, there's probably so much going on with this issue out in the future that we can't clearly see now. I mean, what's the implication of, you know, multiple generations of people been vaccinated like this, and they just keep rolling out more and more vaccines? It just seems like, you know, this is going to be a contributive factor to a lot of illness like cancer and sterility, et cetera. It's just, so I think, you know, when you use the word genocide, that's really not an exaggeration of what we're dealing with. And a lot of it, you know, that's the problem, is we just can't really see. It's so hard to prove sometimes, you know, how all this comes together. But obviously, you know, when you inject a bunch of toxic things into people's bloodstream, you shouldn't be surprised if you get a bad effect. So
shouldn't be. And yet, you know, we have people who have difficulty dealing with the idea that you couldn't trust your health authorities. People both in and out of the medical profession, parents, other citizens, doctors, and so forth. So it's really hard, and it's understandable. It's really understandable to me that it's hard for people to believe that there could be something as wrong as you and I believe and discuss on this show and elsewhere going on in the world today. And of course, vaccines is not the only arena where that happens. It happens throughout healthcare. It happens in other industries and other arenas as well. It really, the vaccine issue is a huge one, but it's not the only one. And it really is indicative of what's going on in the world in a larger sense, and as if the vaccine issue alone were not enough to rattle your cage a little bit once you really begin to see what's going on. Well, Rich, let's see if we can squeeze in one more article here. We've got about 3 minutes.
Okay.
I'm going to close out with an original song of mine that we hear part of at the beginning of the show and on my ads as well. I'll play the whole song for you at the end here. It's about 4 minutes long. That'll give me time to sign off as host and for the host of the next show to sign in and be ready and start on time for the show immediately following this. But 2.5 minutes here, Rich, what can we...
Well, here's a really quick one. Here's a really quick one. And so I don't know what this means exactly, Alan, but this is from Health on Today, a very short article by Rachel Rettner. And the title is Negative Vaccine Tweets Are Contagious, Study Suggests. And after looking at 300,000 tweets, and I don't tweet, Alan, I think you actually tweet, but they were looking at kind of tweets regarding the H1N1 flu vaccine, and this is coming from 2009. And what they found was that whenever kind of negative vaccine sentiments were tweeted, as in people were against the vaccine or against the flu vaccine or didn't think it was safe or effective, that that was contagious and there would be additional remarks made or kind of replies made to those tweets. But when the tweets were positive about the flu vaccine, then there didn't seem to be as much response. So, you know, I'm looking for any bit of good news here, Alan. So it seemed like at least people were talking up the negative aspect of the flu vaccine in 2009 more than the positive aspect of it.
Yeah, and I had people call me during the pandemic who said, I don't have any problem with vaccines, but what's going on with this swine flu shot? There was something about the pandemic that just really failed
right.
in terms of what they were trying to do. It didn't do whatever it was they wanted to do. It didn't really reach that and achieve that. Of course, they want to study this to find out how they can get the positive tweets to be the ones that are you know, the ones that are spread around. But, you know, this is just sort of human nature. We all focus on the negative news. You know, you don't turn on the 6 o'clock news and see all the great things that happened in the world. You see all the horrible things that happened. That's just, you know,
right.
We're all sort of. So I think that's what's going on there, and I don't think they need to look any further than that to see. Of course, that would be the predictable response, whether it had anything to do with problems with the flu vaccine or not. Well, I'm going to try and sign off here. We're down to about 30 seconds here, Rich, but thank you so much for being here today. And by the way, that also tells us that nothing on the Internet is private or personal. They're going to go find your tweets and, you know, anything else you put on the Internet or
send through
email or whatever. So
you've got
to keep that in mind. But thanks, Rich, for coming on, manager of the Pandemic Response Project at PandemicResponseProject.com. I'm vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips, vaccinerights.com, vaccinerights.com, and we're going to close with an original song of mine called Destiny Freedom. We'll see you next week, folks.
Across this land, both near and far, throughout the human race, with each beating heart, there is a dream whose time has come for us to claim our birthright, each and every one. Evil hands have intervened, controlling from the shadows, think they can't be seen. But we have eyes, see in the dark, to cast a light upon the madness we embark. Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand the truth, transparency, for we must be the masters of our destiny. Upon their face, sincerity, while underneath a self-agenda does proceed. But falsity perfumes the air, the sin screams louder than the finest ever there. They'll fill your place with GMOs, and soon your lineage will never cease to grow. Inject your blood with toxic waste. The world is all that bears if you'll just die in haste. Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand the truth, transparency, for we must be the masters of our destiny. Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand.
masters of our destiny. For we must be the masters of our destiny.
Thank you for using Blog Talk.